changing the way we chill today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The chemicals we use in air conditioning are contributing to global warming. That's why there's a new international agreement to phase them out. We'll hear what that means for the ACs of the future.
Historically, the human species has responded to these moments with bursts of creativity and innovation.
Plus, tips for staying cool without air conditioning from our correspondent in India.
We soak our bed sheets in some water, and the water evaporates at night and keeps you cool.
Also, how President Obama's latest round of directives on Cuba chips away at the embargo.
And that kind of is what many people see after this sixth round. You know, the embargo, what embargo?
The stories ahead on The World. Glad you could make it today. A fall day here in Boston with highs in the 70s, reaching the 80s tomorrow. Makes me almost wish I hadn't removed the air conditioner. Just bought it this year. The next time I need a new one, it'll probably function a lot better for the planet. That's because of an agreement made this past weekend in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Let me explain. Most of the world's air conditioners and refrigerators and other cooling devices currently rely on coolants that are really bad for the climate. These coolants are HFCs, or hydrofluorocarbons, and when they get into the air, they're super powerful greenhouse gases. But a few days ago at that meeting in Kigali, representatives from just about every country in the world agreed to phase those chemicals out. For the climate, it's a really big deal.
There's estimates out there that the reduction in global average temperature from this agreement will be somewhere near half a degree Celsius.
That's Nihar Shah of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. Half a degree Celsius might not sound like much, but it could make a huge difference. And Shah says the climate may even get a twofer in the coolant deal.
There's also potentially further reduction from improvements in efficiency, which may go even further.
In other words, new cooling units will likely use a lot less electricity, and that means less pollution from burning coal and natural gas. So it's potentially a big win for the future of the planet. But there are concerns, mostly about the cost of switching to new cooling technologies and what that will mean for people around the world who might not be able to afford them. That's a big worry in India, where tens of millions of people are only now able to afford the old school air conditioning technology that's causing so many environmental problems. Reporter Chavi Sachdev is our eyes and ears in Mumbai. I asked her what the biggest concerns are for people there.
There are two things. One is the affordability, and two is the phasing in of the R&D. There's not enough, supposedly, research to just come in, swoop in, and just replace all the old air conditioners with new technology. This does exist. We do have more environmentally friendly coolants for refrigerators as well as air conditioners and cars available in India, but they are not that easily accessible. A normal air conditioner costs something like $300. That's the starting price, and that's pretty steep. A middle-class family may have to put aside money or pay in monthly installments to afford that. But the one air conditioner I found that has the best coolant, which has no global warming potential or ozone depletion potential, costs $1,500. I can't afford that. That's more than my monthly rent.
How big is the air conditioner market in India, Chavi? I mean, are we making a wrong assumption here that everybody wants AC?
So it's definitely aspirational. You know, we live in the tropics. It's very, very hot. But it's always been unaffordable for a vast majority of our population. And we have frequent power cuts outside the city. So for lots of people, it's a liability. We had 10 million units sold in 2015. But that's like 6% of our population. That's not a huge number.
So what would you say the impact would be on, like, the middle class? I mean, maybe this is the first time they can afford an air conditioner. If the price goes up, are they priced out of the market?
They will be. But again, I don't think that's going to happen for another 12 years. So, you know, go out and buy with impunity.
Whatever you want in the years until then, that's what you're saying?
Yes.
So that sounds like it could have a different kind of impact.
Yeah, people might start stockpiling air conditioners for all you know.
And it won't be much help to reverse climate change, will it?
Not in the present scenario. Of course, we're hopeful that they will start phasing this in sooner. India has seemed quite willing to compromise on their original start date. The base date was even further out. So maybe all our accomplished scientists will come back and really make this technology available. A mass production will happen and everybody will be able to afford clean, green air conditioners soon.
I mean, that sounds kind of utopian, but are Indians in a position to innovate this technology on their home turf?
I would love to say yes, but you know, Dr. Apte, whom I spoke to earlier, she actually said it would be so nice if all the researchers and scientists that we've sent over to the US would come back and help us deal with this problem. So I assume she was a little pessimistic about home turf yielding good results so far.
So I'm curious, Chavi, in a tropical climate where a lot of people don't buy air conditioners, how do they deal with the heat?
So if you're not in a humid place, now I live in Mumbai, which is super humid. If you're not in a humid place, we have these very low energy consuming, very cost effective water coolers, which essentially run on these old principles. You just blow air over a small pool of water and you're set. It's really great. You can even put fragrant grass in there. It smells amazing. My grandparents' house used to smell so fragrant.
And no impact on climate change.
Not much impact. Little electricity. And another thing I do this, is we soak our bed sheets in some water and the water evaporates at night and it keeps you cool. So you cover yourself with it, not sleep on it.
Right. I wish I'd known that when I was in India. Chavi, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Marco.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev there in Mumbai. You heard Chavi mention the hope that some of the scientists who've left India to work overseas will come back and help the country solve its air conditioning challenge. Well, Nihar Shah, we heard from him earlier, is actually one of those scientists. He got his engineering degree in Mumbai, but he doesn't work in India. Still, he may be able to pull an oar from afar. That's because Shah heads up research on new heating and cooling technologies at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in California. And he's pretty certain that air conditioning will remain affordable in places like India, despite the phase-out of the current generation of refrigerants.
A study that we did showed that the cost of the refrigerant in India is about 1% of the total life cycle cost. So if you take that into account, even if the cost of the refrigerant increases, it doesn't necessarily price the air conditioner out of the reach of a middle-class consumer. And of course, a lot of the developed countries will go first. So they'll develop the technology and hopefully bring the cost down for everybody.
So this is one of those moments we call a technological pivot point. Concerns about environmental impacts have pushed out old technologies, but now we've got concerns about access and affordability of the new technologies. Kind of been through this before on car emissions and even the previous generation of coolant technology. What do you expect to see as an outcome from this move on ACs?
Well, I think historically the human species has responded to these moments with bursts of creativity and innovation. And so I expect that the brightest people around the world will get together and really focus on the problem and try and get some more useful technology that can solve this problem online. And it's already happening. You know, some of these new refrigerants are already in place in some sectors, and I expect that trend to continue as well as the cost to come down.
So what are some of the new air conditioning technologies coming along?
Well, there's a couple of refrigerants online already. And then in addition, there's other kinds of technologies that are, I would say, non-compressor using technologies that could be used as well. So I think it's a combination of things that will be available in the future.
I've heard about a personal cooling device that you could even wear around your wrist. Are some of these technologies still kind of in the science lab phase?
Yeah, I would agree that the personal coolant that you refer to probably is in that phase. Some of these technologies are in the lab, but when I'm talking about sort of the more mainstream things that people are going to be using, are already being sold in India today at cost competitive prices today.
So, Nihar, 100 years down the road, how do you think people will be cooling themselves all over the planet?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think, you know, traditional technologies have been used historically. I think evaporative cooling and, you know, painting roofs white, planting more trees. There's so many other ways that we have had to cool ourselves. I think those things are never going to go out of fashion. And certainly there will be other technologies that you and I can't imagine that are on their way, that the brightest, you know, young engineers and scientists are going to be thinking up. So I'm optimistic for the future of the human species. I think we're very ingenious and innovative. So I think we'll definitely think up something.
Nihar Shah of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California speaking with us via Skype from Beijing. Thanks very much, Nihar.
Thank you.
Fans of Cuban rum and cigars got kind of a gift recently. In the past, if you traveled to Cuba, you could only bring back $100 worth of those Cuban products to the U.S. But President Obama, through executive action, eliminated that $100 cap last week. Univision's David Adams has been following the story closely. He says that, on paper at least, the president's moves are a big deal.
Besides the rum and the cigars that you mentioned, the new regulations would apply to American pharmaceutical companies wishing to do research in Cuba, as is infrastructure, some slightly vague, all-encompassing word. And perhaps the biggest thing of all is the notion that American companies can now do business with state-owned companies in Cuba. That had been a no-no previously. Everything had been, all the regulations for commerce with Cuba had been directed at the private sector in Cuba, which is what the U.S. really has its eye on developing and encouraging.
Mm. So I know you follow this stuff pretty closely. Did this move come as a surprise to you?
Well, I suppose actually it did. All the other moves that have been done, and this is the sixth round, by the way, were telegraphed, and people who were in the know, basically people who were being consulted periodically by the White House, were getting a heads up. This one appears to have had less of that, and so did come as a bit more of a surprise.
I mean, reversioning these laws is basically creating commercial facts on the ground. Can this be undone?
Well, I think anything can be undone, and they're not facts on the ground yet. I mean, they're pieces of paper. And until the Cuban government decides that this is an opportunity that it would like to take advantage of, they're pieces of paper that are going to sit there. I mean, what's clear is the Cubans are going to be very selective about who they deal with. And this is going to be a matter of trust. American companies who go into Cuba or who make overtures to the Cuban government and do it in a sort of typical capitalist way of doing business are probably going to fail. The Cubans are looking for kind of special relationships, commercial relationships built on trust. They are super suspicious of everybody, and they have this ideological reluctance of giving up their quote-unquote sovereignty. When it comes to American companies, say, going down to Cuba, setting up businesses, offering their products, buying Cuban things, selling those in the United States, the state in Cuba has controlled everything, and it's just not in their nature to allow the private sector to do its thing.
But ultimately, is the end goal, do you think, of moves like these to lift, you know, the E word?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, Obama obviously doesn't have very much time left in power. He knows he can't touch the embargo. The embargo is written in stone. It's a law. So he can only go so far. All of these measures are designed to undermine the embargo, to make it almost moot, if you like. And that kind of is what many people see after this sixth round. You know, the embargo, what embargo? But again, everything stays the same until the Cubans decide to make their move.
David Adams, an editor with the Univision Network, speaking with us from Miami. Thank you very much.
My pleasure indeed.
Coming up later in the show, Major League Baseball takes its game to Africa. Stick around. You're with the world. For several years, we've heard a lot about Central Americans fleeing violence back home and heading to the U.S. Many end up in detention centers here, but some are released from those centers and they fight deportation from outside the razor wire. That freedom comes with conditions, though, conditions that some immigrants say makes life extra tough. Here's a story of one woman here in Boston. She's from El Salvador, but hopes to stay in the U.S. Reporter Heidi Shin recently caught up with her.
I meet Estella at home. It's morning, and she's finished working all night at a fish factory. She tells me about her job while her 2-year-old girl plays. Her friend translates.
So basically, we select the best-looking fillets, and we also have to take out the little worm. We have to take out the bones.
She inspects hundreds of fish a night. When Estella gets home at 8 a.m., her 2 older boys are already at school. Before noon, she picks up her toddler from daycare. But on Tuesdays, things are different. That's when an immigration officer is supposed to come by. Last September, Estela and her kids fled El Salvador. An armed gang threatened to recruit her teenage son. Estela says that she knew what happened to some boys who defied these gangs. They disappeared. At the Texas border, the family was put in detention. They were released based on their asylum claim. Now, on Tuesdays, Estela stays alert all day, waiting for the immigration officer to check on her. There's no set time.
So she's afraid she can't sleep because she's afraid that they'll ring the bell and she won't hear it and she won't open the door for them. She'll be in trouble.
If she misses the doorbell, there are consequences. For one, the GPS ankle bracelet could come back. It's black and bulky, and Estela wore it for months after detention, in bed, at work, in the shower. Estela worries the bracelet will get attached again if she misses the officer's visit.
Is it uncomfortable?
Es incómodo.
Sí, es bien incómodo.
Yes, it's uncomfortable, she says.
Incluso son como descargas de corriente.
Yeah, you actually feel the electrical current sometimes.
It's like a prickling sensation, Estela says, who asked not to use her full name while her case is pending. Also, the monitor needs recharging several times a day, which means waiting, tethered to an outlet for 2 hours at a time. While Estela waits for the officer to knock, her baby fusses, having missed all her naps. And the phone rings, a lot.
Hello? Uh-huh.
It's the baby's father. He's still in detention. Next, her attorney calls with her next court date. The outlook for the family is unknown. Asylum cases can be hard to win. By 3 p.m., Estela's eyelids are heavy with sleep. The immigration officer hasn't arrived yet. Her two older boys are home from school by now. The teenager heads for his room. The 12-year-old fiddles with his phone at the kitchen table. He's made two friends at school, also boys who've just come from El Salvador. His mom says they never talk about crossing the border. At 3:55 p.m., there's finally a knock on the door.
Estela
rushes to answer the door, thinking it's the immigration officer, but it's not.
No.
No?
No sé.
Hello. Hi.
It's a delivery man. In fact, Estela says, sometimes the immigration officer doesn't show up at all, skips a week or two without letting her know. Estela closes the door and heads straight to her bedroom to sleep. She needs to be back to work at the fish factory in just a few hours. For The World, Heidi Shin, Boston.
Heidi's story was produced with the support of the Images and Voices and Hope Restorative Narrative Fellowship. Here's another immigration story out of Boston. This one involves some folks who are involved in a struggle not far from our own studios. They're dining hall workers at Harvard University, and they're on strike asking for better pay and benefits. The World's Matthew Bell met some of them earlier today.
We got to keep the line moving, all right? Let's get the line back up. Sound good?
Union organizer Kelly McGuire switches from English to Spanish when he speaks to the group of striking workers outside of the Harvard Business School. Negotiations between Harvard and the Dining Hall Workers Union have been going on 5 months now, but 2 weeks ago, more than 700 workers walked off the job. Now, there are scenes like this every morning in several places around Harvard. The union reckons about half of the dining hall workers are immigrants. One of them is Dora Gladys Romero. She's 55, born in El Salvador. She's been working for dining services at Harvard Business School for a dozen years. Romero says she was hesitant at first about going on strike.
Because you get scared. You don't know what we're walking into, you know.
And what were you thinking?
We might not get what we want. Like, we might lose our jobs, too.
Romero says she came to the U.S. 40 years ago. She's raised 5 kids here. They're all grown up now, so it's just her and her husband, and they both rely on the health care benefits she gets from her job as a server. Romero says she loves her job. She wants to keep working for Harvard. It's just that Boston is an expensive place to live, starting with housing.
We have to pay mortgages. Like, I'm paying $2,600 a month. You think $20 an hour is enough? For me, it's not enough. For people who have to send the kids to the babysitters, to daycares, to colleges, to universities, how can we do that?
Romero was among a small group of women arrested last week for blocking traffic in Harvard Square. Both she and co-worker Annie Montoya say they had never done anything like that before. Montoya says they were nervous about committing an act of civil disobedience.
It was scary, of course. Nobody wants to be in that kind of problems. But I didn't feel alone. So I feel that I could do it, and I did. And if it's the only way, obviously it's no violence. We are no criminals. We're just speaking up.
All the charges against Montoya and Romero were dropped, but they'll still have an arrest record. Harvard says it's ready to talk with the workers' union to find what it calls a fair and reasonable resolution. University officials also say dining hall workers already receive highly competitive salaries. Antoine Gabriel Bourgault agrees that Harvard's a great place to work. He was born in Aleppo, Syria. Bourgault is 70. He's been serving food at the business school for 28 years, and he says he still believes strongly in the Harvard brand.
As a union worker, you are proud to be working with this institution to build a better society and a better world. But also I believe that Harvard is directed by human beings and they can do a lot of time bad judgment.
Bourgault told me that he decided to go on strike when Harvard tried to push more health costs onto workers. He says the university's not being reasonable. And so, for now, he'll continue to show up every morning on the picket line. Bourgault also told me he's refusing to take the strike pay offered by the union. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Major League Baseball is looking for talent in Africa, and this South African coach says they've come to the right place.
We've got a very good youth development program in South Africa. Uganda is coming up. We also have Ghana, Zimbabwe, Ivory Coast. So the game is spreading in Africa.
Play ball. That's still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Hard-nosed military types often nod to football coach Vince Lombardi's line, "If you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late. If you're late, don't even bother showing up." So it would seem to be a positive sign that in Iraq, the National Army and pro-government militias are ahead of schedule in their advance on the ISIS stronghold of Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city. ISIS has been in control of Mosul since 2014. As the Iraqi army advances, some of my colleagues at the BBC, including reporter Jonathan Beale, are with them.
We traveled in a bullet-ridden Humvee, our convoy tentatively moving forward in the tracks already cleared of roadside bombs. 2 years ago, the Iraqi army fled from IS, but now with Western help, the tide is turning. At our first stop, an Iraqi commander pointed out the position still under IS control. They'll have to clear about 80 villages before they reach the outskirts of the city. But they tell me they're determined to defeat IS in their last major stronghold in Iraq, even though the conditions are harsh. We continued the move north, deeper into IS-held territory, looking out for potential threats.
The first phase of this operation is slow and careful. We're traveling through desert and the Iraqi army are taking village by village. The main threats here are minefields, suicide truck bombs, and mortars. And we're still about 30 miles from Mosul itself.
Then the first signs of resistance. A tank fired at a suicide truck bomb before it could wreak its havoc. This, the aftermath of the massive explosion. They used a rocket when they spotted what they said was an IS convoy about to make an escape from one of the outlying villages. But they say they're also being helped with intelligence provided by Iraqi citizens still living under IS control.
They gave us a lot of information, how they escaped, how many they carry weapon, they don't carry weapon, they have a motorcycle, they have a heavy machine gun, they don't have it, they escape north, east, west.
So you've got people inside who are passing information to you?
We have sources.
The Iraqi army is among few of the forces that will be allowed to enter Mosul. The majority of its troops are Shia, reflecting the population of the country. They still hope they'll be greeted as liberators in a city mostly made up of Sunnis. But there are also fears this fight could end with a more divided country.
The BBC's Jonathan Beale there on the front lines with the Iraqi army. The Mosul offensive will likely create a new wave of refugees. It might also send ISIS fighters fleeing as well, and some of those fighters could head to Europe. In fact, the EU Security Commissioner warned today that Europe needs to gird itself for the likely arrival of militant jihadis. Almost as if on cue, Belgian police took in 15 people for questioning after ISIS-related raids. A new Frontline documentary airing tonight looks at Europe's efforts to battle terror. It examines the missteps and intelligence breakdowns that led to the Charlie Hebdo slayings, as well as the big attacks in Paris and in Brussels over the past year. The documentary is a joint project with ProPublica. Correspondent Sebastian Rotella led the investigation.
I've covered most of the major terrorist attacks, going back to 9/11 and in Europe, and almost always there are moments where there were glimmers of a plot or of an individual, and that people only understand afterward. What is, I think, striking here is, number one, almost everyone was known to authorities. And we're talking about, two dozen people involved in these plots. And many of them were even stopped, questioned, and arrested, right? They were known as extremists. I mean, it's kind of excruciating, the series of missed opportunities. But the problem is that as good as the European counterterror forces are, and they know the threat and the enemy well, there are these structural problems that have existed for a long time that people have been complaining about and concerned about but haven't been fixed, with things like borders, where it's just very easy, and even if you're wanted or on a watch list, to cross Europe's international borders and go in and out to places like Syria. There aren't databases where somebody in one country, in an effective real-time way, can find out that someone in another country is somebody of concern.
When you look at what else Europe is dealing with now, it's kind of mind-boggling. Brexit, the immigration crisis, growing fault lines in the European Union. And a country like Belgium is right in the middle of this whole storm, and it's admittedly quite unprepared. Here's the voice of Alain Grignard, a senior counterterrorism officer in Belgium.
It's a bit too easy for all these big countries with a lot of police officers and foreign intelligence services to criticize Belgium. We're a small country. We don't have a police culture. We don't have our own foreign intelligence service. It's impossible to keep an eye on everyone. 24-hour surveillance with just two people happens only in TV shows. So this means we can only watch a few individuals. People don't quite realize this.
Sebastian Rotella, that's kind of the bottom line, isn't it? They can't watch everyone. Do Belgians, do the French, do Europeans accept that defense?
Alain Grignard and some of the other people in Belgian counterterrorism are some of the best, most experienced, knowledgeable counterterror investigators in Europe. But the Belgian security forces, even though there's been intense networks that have been active in Belgium since the 1990s, Islamic extremist networks, have had a series of tools that exist in other countries, including France right next door, like the intelligence service being able to use wiretaps, like certain laws in terms of doing raids or following people. The laws are very restrictive. The budgets have always been very limited, and it's been a real struggle. And there was this explosion of radicalization. Belgium has sent proportionally the biggest number of fighters to Syria to join ISIS and other groups, and that just overwhelmed the defenses.
Near the end of your doc, you've got Eric Vandersip. He's a Belgian terror prosecutor, and he's got this chilling notion. Let's just hear this.
People that want to die, they're not afraid to die, and they're not afraid to kill other people while doing so.
So with that acceptance of the situation, Sebastian Rotella, and that is a smart, level-headed guy, it seems, is this just going to be the normal for everyone in the West? Thousands of radicals in Europe ready to die?
To some extent, yes. I mean, we should be measured and precise, right? The threat varies from one country to another, but there is this potential. There is this dangerous, scary, new nihilistic culture that really blurs criminality and extremism, where people who are gangsters or small-time criminals already, often of Muslim descent or converts, radicalize very quickly, particularly because ISIS has this hyper-violent, this culture of barbarity that attracts them. They can go from being criminals to being terrorists very quickly, and it is a particularly savage and excessive and brutal culture. So, yes, it is a new problem that challenges the police. For example, you know, Belgian police will tell you that they had to bring in their anti-gang units to help the terrorism units because there was too much work. And the anti-gang units knew all of the people that the terrorism units were dealing with because they were criminals who crossed the lines between terrorism and criminality. So that, I think, is a new challenge that is a tough one to deal with and that to some extent in some countries will be the new normal.
Do you know if there's been any gains or progress in interoperability between EU nations, their data and intel? I mean, is that getting shared now?
They're certainly working hard. They've beefed up the European Border Agency. They say they're working harder on things like foreign fighter lists and intelligence sharing. There's a lot of initiatives. There's a lot of political will. There's a lot of recognition of the problem and that new things need to be done. A uniform advanced airline screening measure was just passed, and that's going to be Europe-wide when it comes into effect. It's going to take a couple of years. So there have been some steps, but unfortunately, there's another current that goes in the opposite direction. Some of the top people we talked to said, unfortunately, because of things like Brexit, because of the immigration issue, there's a tendency still not to share intelligence, to raise barriers rather than limit them. I find it hard to believe that Europe could create a Europe-wide intelligence service, right? That's a distant goal. So cooperation is just going to have to get better, and people are working at it, but it's a work in progress.
ProPublica's Sebastian Rotella talking about the frontline documentary Terror in Europe that's airing tonight. You can read Sebastian's long-form story on the subject. We've got it at PRI.org. Sebastian, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
When it comes to fighting ISIS, Russia says it's in on the fight. But here's the thing. Most of Moscow's military effort is directed against the opponents of its ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. That includes a furious aerial bombardment on rebel-held eastern Aleppo. Secretary of State John Kerry this week accused Russia of pursuing a Grozny strategy in Aleppo. David Filipov is the Washington Post's new Moscow bureau chief. So you covered Russia and Chechnya for 10 years back during the troubles there in the 1990s, David. What was John Kerry talking about? Remind us what happened in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya.
Okay, so starting in 1994, when the Russian army went into Chechnya, it faced a smaller but determined amount of rebels who were in the city and used the city to protect themselves. And so basically the Russian tactic was to go building by building, block by block, with artillery and airstrikes, and with, it seemed to everyone on the ground, relatively minimal concern for the people who were in the city who weren't among the fighters. Now, that happened in the first war from 94 to 96. The Russians kind of negotiated a peace deal, and then they went back in 1999, and by all accounts, that was far more brutal. I was actually there in a situation where a Russian unit was telling its forces to cease fire so that some civilians could get out of a building. So it's not like it was universally just kill everybody in the city. But what ended up happening is they would go block by block, level, 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 until you had nothing but rubble. It was remarkable to see entire areas that were just essentially rubble and some stuff, but basically just street names with nothing there but rubble.
The Russian embassy in Washington responded to John Kerry yesterday on Twitter with a series of really glittering images of modern Grozny and these words, "Grozny today is a peaceful, modern, and thriving city. Ain't that a solution we're all looking for?" End quote. So I got to ask, is Grozny today really as beautiful as the images suggest?
Yeah, I mean, I was there a couple of years ago and I looked out from a building that had been rebuilt on a building that I saw leveled. And it did look, it looked like somebody had built a model city. It was 2013, and there's neat squares, and there's statues, and there are monuments, and there are tree-lined boulevards, and it's the same place that I saw completely decimated. And it has been built up, and there has been a lot of investment, and it looks great.
I guess we could say that Secretary Kerry, in referencing Grozny in relation to Aleppo, he's criticizing Russia's apparent indifference to the human cost of victory. What was the human cost of the battles for Grozny?
Well, first of all, Grozny was a Russian city, or rather a Russian-speaking city. Half of the people who lived there weren't Chechens at all, and therefore could not possibly have been separatists. Plus, they were generally the older people, the pensioners, and they were the ones who were stuck there because they were the ones who didn't have relatives. They were the ones who couldn't get away. So when the bombardment was happening, and I'm talking about the beginning of the first war, when the bombardment was happening and people were saying, stop, let these people out, and President Yeltsin at the time was saying, there's nobody left in that city but rebels, that was the problem. The problem was that the innocents, who could not possibly have been part of any rebellion, were the ones bearing the brunt of the bombardment, because a few armed people would be in a neighborhood and the planes would come and level the neighborhood. When they talk about different things. Secretary Kerry is talking about the prosecution of those wars. Russian embassy is talking about the long, laborious reconstruction from, say, 2005 till now, which has left, you know, a relatively stable police state, but at least a police state where you're not getting blown up every day by planes and where things more or less work. There are two different visions. And the question is, do you have to go through one to get to the other? Is the only way to get to that quasi, you know, nice place to live that Chechnya is now, is the only way to get to that by completely, you know, decimating it in 1999?
So today with Aleppo and Syria, is the implication from the Russian embassy that peace through carpet bombing is sometimes necessary?
The Russian line is that in order to wipe out what they considered an intractable enemy, you know, Islamic terrorists, you had to get them, you had to root them out completely. And if that meant blowing away block by block, then so be it. That was worth it to get rid of them. And their argument is that in supporting factions of the rebels, we're allowing basically the, you know, the Russian line is we are, the United States and its allies are allowing the rebels to stay alive and to continue this resistance. So the Russian tactic will be to eliminate any possibility that rebels could be in there. And if that means that the city has to die, then so be it, because that's the greater good of defeating ISIS and Islamic rebels.
David Filipov, the new Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, thanks for walking us through the Grozny-Aleppo linkage.
All right, thank you.
Let me tell you about a story we'll have for you tomorrow about refugees who settle in the United States. Refugees from Syria, for example, see a police car coming and they get worried about arrest or worse, but not in Boise, Idaho.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm Officer Robinson with the Boise.
Boise appointed a special police officer who works full-time getting to know refugees and earning their trust.
The tires were slashed.
Yeah.
Were destroyed.
And the effort seems to be paying off.
In U.S. Customs, police officers are oftentimes called by, you know, officer and their last name. But I get called Officer Dustin by almost every refugee that I come in and encounter with. And I don't know if it's just because there's a comfort and a trust level there, but I know that the previous refugee liaison officer was called Officer Shelley.
We'll meet Officer Shelley and Officer Dustin, Boise's refugee cops, tomorrow on the program. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to the world. So the Boston Red Sox are out of the playoff picture this year. Hey, there's always next year, as they say. I did see that the Cleveland Indians beat the Toronto Blue Jays last night to take a commanding lead in the American League Championship Series. And here's a fact for you. Of the 18 players in last night's starting lineups, half were born outside of the U.S., Major League Baseball has done a good job of finding talented young players abroad, especially in countries like Venezuela and the Dominican Republic. But now the majors are hoping to find their players in other parts of the world, and they're looking pretty much everywhere. Our colleagues at the BBC spent time with one young South African who dreams of making it to the majors.
Hey, play doubles now! Play doubles!
I've been playing baseball since I was 7 years old. My name is Kogezo Manamela. I'm from Alexandra in Johannesburg. I'm 18 this year. Soon I have trials for Major League Baseball camp.
Three! Stay alive!
So right now I'm working on pitching and hitting the right zone. And he's working on his batting stance and making sure that he hits right side. Hey, nice boy! My goals in the sport is to get signed and play abroad.
My name is Americo Juma. I'm 34 years old. Originally, I'm from Zimbabwe. My job is coaching baseball. I'm from South Africa Baseball Union, working in connection with MLB, Major League Baseball. This is the play ball program that we are running for the township kids. Step and throw. Okay, let's go. Major League Baseball has started investing in Africa. I think they've noticed that there is talent in Africa. Go hard, boy. Go hard, go hard. All the way, all the way. You're not running. Go. There is a great future for African baseball. There is a lot of potential in Africa. We've got a very good youth development program in South Africa, and it's moving and it's excelling, and we do have lots of talent in that program. And we also have Uganda is coming up. We also have Kenya. We also have Ghana, Zimbabwe. We've got Ivory Coast. And we have got Tanzania is also playing baseball. So the game is spreading in Africa.
Good job, let's go.
MLB, one more. Are realizing that there's untapped talent, there is raw talent in Africa. It's my message to the Americans saying, hey guys, watch out, the African players are coming. The African players are coming, they just need time.
One, two, three, Vegas!
Today we're playing against the Wolves. Right now I'm a bit nervous because I've never faced the pitcher before. But I think I'll do what's right.
I believe that MLB has seen that there's a wide variety of talent that is in not only South Africa but in the entire continent as a whole. I believe that through my hard work and determination, I will make it to the MLB.
That was 17-year-old Koketso Manamela and his coach Americo Juma in Johannesburg. With me now to discuss Major League Baseball's expansion into Africa is Anders Kelto. He spent 4 years reporting for us in South Africa. So tell us a little more about the program that Koketso is preparing for, Anders.
So he's trying to make it to what's called the African Elite Camp. It's this program that was started by Major League Baseball about 5 years ago. And the idea is they identify talented players from all across the continent, bring them to this camp, in 1-week-long camp in Cape Town. Scouts from the U.S. come and identify talented players and maybe even sign them to a professional contract. Recently, it's mostly been players from South Africa and Uganda, which apparently have the two most well-developed baseball programs in Africa.
So this is called the African Elite Camp, obviously geared toward the African continent. Why Africa? And is this happening with the major leagues in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I think there's sort of this sense that Africa is this huge untapped market, right? There's about 1 billion people living there. And I think this is equal parts talent search and brand promotion. I mean, Major League Baseball obviously has an interest in building its fan base, including in parts of Africa. They can sell more jerseys. They can get more viewership. And so they benefit from this type of program, even if they don't sign the next Derek Jeter.
Right. Have they discovered any diamonds yet?
I'm told that there are 6 or 7 African-born, African-raised players who are now in the U.S. farm systems. There's one guy named Gift Ngope, who is a top prospect apparently for the Pittsburgh Pirates. And is apparently a very promising talent. He actually has a pretty amazing story. He literally grew up in the clubhouse where his mom was the janitor for the local baseball team.
Wow.
But to date, no African-born player has started a Major League Baseball game. But the people I've been speaking with say that they are hopeful that that day will come soon.
I can just imagine the obstacles to getting to good baseball in sub-Saharan Africa. You got to build facilities, set up at least some small competitive league, train coaches, and then there's soccer. You got to compete with that too. Not to mention the question, how do you play the game? What success have African countries actually had with baseball so far?
Well, you're exactly right. It's hugely challenging. I mean, soccer is the sport in Africa. And if you think about it, it's very easy to organize a soccer game. All you need is a little bit of space and a ball. Game on. With baseball, you need at least a few more players, you need bats, ideally you would have gloves, and you need a lot more space because you hit the ball a lot farther. So, and if you think about how African cities are often laid out, you don't have a lot of space in these crowded urban areas for kids to play. So that is a big challenge. But, you know, baseball has been growing. There are leagues now, club leagues all over South Africa. They've competed in the World Championships on a couple occasions. And so I think, you know, the sport is growing slowly but surely.
Reporter Anders Kelto, formerly with The World in Cape Town, South Africa. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
Here's something else that started in America and then got a South African twist: disco. It came on the scene in South Africa when the apartheid government banned politically conscious musicians, but disco still managed to take some shots at the apartheid government. You can hear that on a new compilation called Boogie Breakdown, South Africa Synth Disco, 1980 to 1984. Neville Nash is one of several artists featured on Boogie Breakdown. Mighty Eye is everywhere. There is no way that you can dare break out. Even in disco, you can feel the strain on South African society. Apartheid was crushing people, and it was hard for them to envision the future. 6 years later, though, in 1990, when Nelson Mandela was released from prison, it would become a lot clearer. We'll leave you with more sounds from 1984 South Africa from the collection Boogie Breakdown. From the Nan and Phil Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.